Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all lived through the boom and bust of the 90s, the mega fortunes won and lost, the deregulation of energy and telecommunications and more, the hope and hype of the new economy and ultimate scandal on Wall Street. Our guest tonight, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, had an intimate inside view of the decade's roller coaster ride as Bill Clinton's top economic advisor and the World Bank's chief economist. Now he shares his story of the roaring 90s and lessons for the future of the U.S. economy. Tonight on Point, Joseph Stiglitz on the inside story of the 90s and America's choices now. But first, California is still burning tonight. Raging infernos from 10 wildfires have destroyed some 1,100 homes and killed at least 13 people in Southern California. The ash and smoke are so thick, airports have been closed. And the Monday night football game scheduled to be played in San Diego has been moved to Arizona. Tony Perry is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times and has been reporting from the front lines. He joins us now. Tony, what's the latest? How fast are homes being enveloped right now?
We hope in San Diego County, where we've lost some 300-plus homes, that the worst is behind us. Several dozen homes have been consumed in the last couple of hours, but even at that, firefighters see a glimmer of hope that the weather is changing, that there are better firefighting techniques. The aerial tankers have now arrived, and we hope that the worst, the absolute worst, is behind us. But we have 10,000 people who are without the homes and living in shelters or in motels and things. So we've been hit very, very hard.
Tony, where have you been today? What have you seen?
Well, San Diego County is really a ring of fire, both in the rural areas into the fancy million-dollar subdivisions, then across an interstate freeway racing towards the depopulated area near the U.S.-Mexican border. San Diego at one point had 100 homes on fire all at one time. And no fire department, particularly one in the city of San Diego, which is stretched thin already, can fight that kind of fire. Fire was making its own wind, its own fuel, was whipping to and fro, and they would set up a perimeter on one side, and then the wind would shift to the other side. So it was virtually the perfect firestorm, if you will, and it consumed, as I say, 300-plus homes, several hundred other buildings. We've had 11 fire deaths. And the sheriff says he's investigating two dozen other cases, so our death toll could rise significantly.
It sounds absolutely terrifying. Has it threatened the city center, the real population center?
Not the center of the city, the downtown, but San Diego, like a lot of Southern California cities or a lot of Sunbelt cities, is very, very spread out. Mm-hmm. It's maybe 50 miles from one end to the other. The fire did sneak in from the rural areas. Hit a large subdivision of million-dollar homes that has these beautiful eucalyptus trees. Well, it hit those trees, and those trees exploded like torches. And on many of the homes, there were these shingle roofs, which are very, very attractive and very, very explosive. And when an ember hits, particularly on a dry, windy day like we've had for the last 48 hours, a roof like that just goes up like a bomb, and that's what we saw. Now, we would see homes to the left and to the right destroyed, a home in the middle possibly with tile roof left untouched.
The NPR news we heard at the top of the hour made it sound as though a number of fires may now be converging. Some already have converged. The tone of that report was that this is by no means under control and could get worse. Is that what you're seeing?
In the sense that it's not under control, that is true. In the sense that it's consuming a lot more acreage, also true. I still think that with nightfall, with better air assets fighting the fire, we've seen the worst in terms of destruction. But the fire is nowhere near under control. And you're right, two fires that had started in separate locations, one near the border, one maybe 50 miles away in a wooded area, are now racing towards each other. Now, to a certain degree, that's not bad. The two of them will meet, essentially, and destroy themselves rather than destroying other things. So while it will be very dramatic, possibly that could be a good move.
Any more word about how these fires were started?
Yes. One fire is under investigation. They really don't know. But the other fire that has burned 150,000 acres, several hundred homes, and caused 9 of the 11 deaths is thought to have been caused by a hunter who, becoming lost, started a signal fire so that his fellow hunter could find him. He was found. He was airlifted out. He was cited initially a misdemeanor for starting a fire in the Cleveland National Forest. Now that there have been this massive loss of property and also lives, those charges may be upgraded significantly to federal felonies.
And finally, Tony, Governor Gray Davis is calling out the National Guard. We hear what's going on in the city of San Diego. Is it at a standstill?
City of San Diego, first of all, the sun was blotted out all today. All you could see, if you could see anything, was an orange ball in the sky. Ash was falling. The city was really depopulated. People had been warned to stay indoors, to keep their children away from outdoors. Schools were closed, businesses closed, government was closed. The U.S. Navy, which never closes, was essentially closed except for law enforcement and anti-terrorism personnel. This fire did something that no other occurrence has ever done. It literally shut down a major American city.
Tony, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Tony Perry is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from San Diego, California. The supercharged economic times of the 1990s may feel distant now, on the far side of a recession and market meltdown. So many of the giddy assumptions of that decade are gone, along with savings and budget surpluses and expectations of more to come. Tonight, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, then chairman of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors and chief economist at the World Bank, weighs in on American economic policy under Clinton, Bush, and beyond. How do you remember the roaring 90s? Do you still believe in freewheeling markets or in greater government oversight? And what are the lessons of that decade? And is the country acting on them? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor of economics at Columbia University, Joseph Stiglitz. He's author of the new book, The Roaring 90s, A New History of the World's Most Prosperous Decade, and the earlier bestseller, Globalization and Its Discontents. He was a member and then chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration from 1993 to 1997, and senior vice president and chief economist of the World Bank from 97 to 2000. Good evening and welcome, Joseph Stiglitz.
Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
So, Joseph Stiglitz, quite a book and quite a story. Elements here that we really hadn't heard, even though we'd lived through the 90s. You left Stanford to join President Clinton's economic team in 1993. Did you have any idea that the decade ahead would unfold as it did? And I guess I want to ask, what surprised you most about what happened?
Well, no, I don't think anybody anticipated. Remember when when Clinton came to Washington in 1993, the economy was still in a recession. And our first task was to try to get the economy out of that recession. And we succeeded. Better in many ways than we had anticipated, and with policies that are still, to some extent, a puzzle. And one of the objectives of my book is to try to explain how we did it and what lessons it has for other countries. In particular, I try to argue that what we did, the standard message of deficit reduction, is bad medicine for almost all other countries facing the challenge of a recovery. But then the next thing was, of course, the way it took off, and the way it became the Roaring 90s, the way it became an unprecedented boom. Even in the beginning, in 93, 94, there were problems. One of the things I talk about in the book is how we were trying to get a better accounting scheme, dealing with the stock options to the CEOs and the problems of that prevailed, and the kind of battles that we fought as early, you know, well before the scandals broke out in this decade, well before that, almost a decade before that, we were aware that there was something wrong. We tried to change things, and yet the, you might say, the vested interests, the people who were benefiting from it, resisted, and unfortunately, they prevailed.
A lot of cross currents described in your book here, but when you say you wrote this to describe how we did it, what do you mean exactly? What are you taking credit for as a policy matter of what unfolded economically in the 90s?
Well, I think one of the things that was important was that we tried to move from to get a right balance between the government and the market, that we recognized that there were some problems back in the regulatory regime that would been set up in the aftermath of the Great Depression was no longer suited to the American economy of the 1990s. On the other hand, we also recognized that the kind of Reaganite economics also wasn't working. It didn't bring what was promised.
We want to look at those, but let me ask just the simple question. Are you saying how we did it? Are you taking credit for the boom itself? Are you saying Clinton policy created this boom?
No, underlying that boom fundamentally was technology. It was advances in science. We tried to maintain those advances in science. We tried to support science and to try to support technology. And clearly some of the things that have been done earlier in terms of the internet played it a very important role. But clearly we can't claim, nobody, you know, that was really the private sector and that was really the market.
So what you could do was have some hand in what was regulated and what was not. And you paint that as right at the heart of both the 90s and kind of American decisions that need making going forward, is what will the relative role be? Where did the balance fall compared to where you wished it would fall between regulation and market forces?
Well, my concern is that we too often took the deregulation mantra too seriously. There was a view that was part of Reagan's era that get rid of regulations as quickly as possible, and we did that. That was done in the Reagan era in the financial markets, and we had the S&L crisis, which we paid very dearly. But we hadn't really learned the lesson of that, and rather than asking the question we should have been asking, which is what is the right regulatory framework, too often we were pushing a deregulation. For instance, another example was that there were clear problems in accounting, and those problems needed to be addressed. There were conflicts of interest in the financial markets, and those problems needed to be addressed. But and deregulating electricity was clearly a very complicated matter. But in each of those areas, as we advanced deregulation, the answers we came up with were not the right answers.
Meaning they were too wide open. Jack Beattie, it's quite a picture that Joseph Stiglitz presents here of this crew coming into Washington, sitting down with an agenda of things they'd like to do, but deciding that the pressure was on, the first thing they had to address was deficits. They couldn't really resist the deregulation dynamic and in some sense surrendering to that.
Yes, in some sense, but this could quickly become a festival unanimity, since I agree with Professor Stiglitz overwhelmingly and was a critic of market fundamentalism before he coined the term, not out of economic acumen, but sheer populist prejudice. From the time of the Little Rock Economic Summit in November 1992, mm-hmm. when the campaign document, Putting People First, gave way to Putting Deficit Reduction First, I was critical of many of these policies, yet I have to say that my views changed under the Clinton experience. Number one, that policy of deficit reduction had a morality to it. We were saying we weren't going to put all this off on our kids. And when I look at my son and when I think of the Social Security taxes he's going to have to pay for me, I say, Bill Clinton, good for you. And second, it worked. That is to say, it didn't, or at least it didn't get in the way of the other things that worked. I don't think Professor Stiglitz gives enough credit to the way in which the deficit reduction, which meant tax increases, which meant cuts in Medicaid and other Medicare and other programs, accommodated lower interest rates. And I think that that was very important in that recovery.
Jack Beatty, Joseph Stiglitz, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the U.S. economy, where it's been and where it's headed, the impact of Clinton policy, Bush policy, and beyond. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What's your question for President Clinton's chief economic advisor, Joseph Stiglitz? If you're having trouble with our number tonight, you can try 617-353-0645. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the U.S. economy, where it's been and where it's headed, the impact of Clinton policy, Bush policy, and beyond. Our guest is Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist. He was a member and then chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from 1993 to 1997 under Bill Clinton, was senior vice president and chief economist at the World Bank from 1997 to 2000. He's author of the new book, The Roaring 90s, A New History of the World's Most Prosperous Decade. You can join the conversation. What did we learn from the 90s? Boom and bust about markets and governments' proper roles. Who lost the cream of the 90s? And are you still a free marketeer? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or if you have trouble with that tonight, try 617-353-0645. Joseph Stiglitz, take us, if you would, into that debate over the time that it went on in the Clinton administration, the agenda that people came in with, what they wanted to do, what it ran up against, what was sacrificed.
Well, let me just first agree with what Jack said, that deficit reduction was important for the long run. Mm-hmm. What I try to argue in the book is that it was not the central piece in the recovery itself. And that's an important lesson for the future, because it means, for instance, one of the problems that many other countries face, the problems of economic recession and downturn. And the question is, what should they do? Should they stimulate the economy with tax cuts or expenditure increases, or should they follow what was described as the recipe for success, deficit reduction? And the answer is unambiguously clear. Economic theory and experience shows that, in general, deficit reduction weakens an economy when it is already weak.
So why did it work for the United States in the 1990s?
Well, there was some very specific situation at the time. There are two factors. The first is it was a very carefully crafted deficit reduction, where the increases in taxes were all aimed at the upper-income individuals, the upper 2%. And so the impact on consumption was much less than it would have been had it been across-the-board tax increase. The second thing, equally important, was the peculiar situation of our banking system at that time. There was a series of mistakes that in regulation that had occurred, beginning with the S&L deregulation, the trying to address that problem, the consequence of which was that the banks had wound up having an incentive to have a lot of long-term government bonds. And when the long-term interest rates fell, the value of those long-term bonds increased. That was a kind of recapitalization of the banking mm-hmm. system. They were able to lend. And it was the lending more than the interest rate itself. It was the availability of credit which helped stimulate the economy.
But you describe the administration running into just a tectonic plate power, mega-size demand that it reduce those deficits and that it listen to Wall Street and the world of finance to take its cues on how to govern the economy.
That's right. I mean, one of the things you have to look at when you have a deficit is what the money is going for. Every business borrows money to do investment. If you can't borrow, you're not going to be able to be in business. We had such a focus on deficit reduction that we weren't able to carry out the kind of agenda that Clinton had come into Washington to achieve. For instance, the basis of the Roaring 90s was our technology, our advances in science. And yet we were not able to put in the kinds of funding for basic research that will provide the kinds of innovation and technology for the next decade and beyond that.
Which means you write that the country was living off its previous public investments in science without making new investments.
Exactly. And we have a weak infrastructure. We have problems in education. And all of that was sacrificed on deficit reduction. If we had a kind of accounting framework like firms have, where you have assets and liabilities, you would recognize that as you're borrowing, if you're using that money well, your assets are increasing even more, and that's increasing your productive potential. But we didn't look at things that way. It was all deficit reduction, deficit reduction, deficit reduction.
And why? Why the one view of everything?
Well, I think the financial markets unfortunately looked at things in a excessively short-sighted way. They didn't see the assets, they only saw the liabilities. They saw the debt, and they didn't see what we got for it. There were elements there that I talk about very in the book, for instance, where we were effectively selling our national security short. We were doing things like one of the things we did is we privatized the U.S. Enrichment Corporation, which is was the government enterprise responsible for making enriched uranium, which is the core ingredient of atomic bombs, and responsible for bringing that highly enriched uranium from the deactivated warheads from Russia into the United States. It was a silly idea, and yet, in order to make our budget look better for 1 year, we went ahead and did that.
So, anything goes. And all of this, you write about the kind of market is the market knows best as a overwhelmingly dominant point of view that ultimately came, even it seems, reading your book, to dominate the Clinton administration. Do you agree?
That's right. It was partly, there was a difficulty. Remember, the Republicans took control of Congress in 1994, and they were, Newt Gingrich was particularly oriented in this market fundamentalism, an extreme view of what ought to be done. And the result of that was that Clinton looked for compromises. And some of those compromises, unfortunately, compromised our country. I mean, for instance, in the middle of this bubble, which inevitably burst, we did what I think is one of the silliest things we could have done. We cut capital gains taxes. It was feeding the frenzy. And it did feed the frenzy, and it did help make the bubble go up higher, which meant when it broke, it came down further.
Mm. So you say, while markets are at the center of the success of our economy, markets do not always work well by themselves. You're looking at why they don't solve all problems, why government will always be, as you say, an important partner to them. What was demonstrated in the 90s? Where did the markets work well? Where did they fall down?
Well, let me explain a little bit about the fundamental idea. One of the basic ideas in economics goes back a long time to Adam Smith. He talked about how self-interest leads, as if by an invisible hand, to economic efficiency and the overall well-being of society. Well, some of the research that I had done in markets with imperfect information, asymmetric information, which means where different people know different things, is that one of the reasons why the invisible hand often seems invisible is that it's not there. And the consequence of that is we saw so manifestly in the 90s that there was bad information, the stock options, the accountants did not have good incentives to provide accurate information. The CEOs had incentives. They could make more money by providing distorted information than by investing in good projects. All of that meant that the prices that were that developed in the markets were based on distorted information, did not reflect reality. Well, prices are important because they help direct investment. So you had investment based on distorted prices, bad information, and that led to the excess investment in some areas. When the bubble broke, we finally realized how much excessive some of that investment is. And in the last couple of years, we've been disinvesting. We've been dealing with the problem of excess capacity. That is a result of the bad information. That in turn was a result of badly designed incentive structures because of bad rules of the game.
Jack Beatty, we're not talking here to someone who was in a marginal position during the 90s or in a powerless position. Joe Stiglitz had the ear of the president, and yet there's this sense that there were tides running here that could not be resisted.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, the part of it was the foundation mistake, really, I think, of the Clinton administration was that partly at the urging of Richard Gephardt, who was then the House Majority Leader, they did not push campaign finance reform, which meant that every other decision of the Clinton administration was heavily influenced by campaign contributions. That's just the fact of it. And it wound up killing his major initiative for ordinary Americans, for the kind of people he grew up with, went to high school with, namely his health care plan. And the result was not just bad policy in some ways, but bad politics. The emphasis on deficit reduction, which I applaud over the long run, over the short run, alienated base voters from the Democratic Party. They had voted for a guy who said we want to put people first, who had an agenda of social investment, who talked about the investment deficit, not just the budget deficit in the way the professor was. They voted for that guy. And the guy they got was Robert Rubin. So in 1994, they stayed home and we got this Republican Congress. So it didn't pay off for Bill Clinton, and we know it didn't pay off for Al Gore.
Joe Stiglitz, what do you make of that analysis?
I think he's exactly right. I think in the end, his campaign finance reform is really at the root of what is at issue. One of the things that I describe in the book is some of the attempts that we had to deal with what is called corporate welfare. We were cutting welfare programs for the poor. It seemed to me only to make sense that we ought to do something about welfare programs for corporations. Mm-hmm. And yet it was so clear that it was almost impossible. The U.S. Treasury, whenever we mentioned the word corporate welfare, they thought that was anti-business. I thought it was pro-business. My view is business needs a level playing field. You need to have regulation so that people can trust in what business is. If you don't have a good set of regulations, how will people have any confidence in the numbers that are reported as the profits? How do they know the CEOs aren't walking away with a lion's share of what is going on? So my view is that these kinds of reforms are actually pro-business, and that if we can get these reforms, the American economy will function better.
We're talking tonight with Nobel Prize-winning economist and one-time chairman of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, Joseph Stiglitz. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, or maybe tonight with our funny phones, 617-353-0645. John is calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm really glad you're having this conversation because I was thinking about this kind of stuff this morning when I heard on the news about Bank of America acquiring Fleet Bank, and I'm old enough to remember when there were laws prohibiting banks from operating very much in more than one state, and if I'm not mistaken, these were the results of the whole antitrust movement of the early 20th century. I'm not sure when all that changed, and I'm not sure why or whether it's a good thing. I'd like to hear your guests' comments about this.
It's a great question. Now we've got a mega merger underway, Bank of America trying to create a real national bank. Joseph Stiglitz, where do you put this in your scheme of things?
Well, I actually don't think this is one of the primary problems that is facing the country, but it is an interesting issue because it actually touches on another issue that I do talk about in the book, which is the issue of globalization. The reason that these laws on interstate banking were passed in the 19th century was there was a real worry that the large money center banks in New York, Chicago, would siphon off all of the savings from the Midwest, from the West, from all rural areas in our country, and it would impede the development of the country, a broad-based development. I think there was a lot of legitimacy to that concern, and I think there were some questions about whether we should do something about that. But the reason that particular law was changed in 1995 was that they had found ways of circumventing the law that it looked like it would be difficult to address. But the reason I raise this in the context of globalization is the following. The United States and Europe have insisted that less developed countries open their markets to the international banks. And what is happening in country after country is these big international banks come into a country. They basically drive out of business local banks. They provide loans to the big international companies like Coca-Cola or IBM, but they leave starving for funds small and medium-sized enterprises within these countries.
So you're saying the medicine of mega mergers in the banking industry is okay for the United States, but not good globally?
What I'm saying is that we have now a sophisticated, well-functioning enough banking system that I think we can handle it. It raises questions. I think we should keep our eye on it. But what I can say without, in very much agreement with the person calling in, that outside the United States, with less developed countries whose state of development is actually lower than ours was 100 years ago, this is really problematic.
Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Good evening.
I just wanted to follow up on the comment that Joseph made about the issue of how they cut welfare for the poor, but they didn't cut corporate welfare. And I feel that's like further proof that it's impossible to make things fair, that in fact deficit reduction really became an attack on poor and working class people, but not really about making things fair or more equal. And I wanted to know if he feels that's further evidence that it's very hard to use government in a way that makes capitalism fair.
You just don't believe it can be done, Chris?
I don't believe it can be done. Yeah, I feel that the boom of the 90s and the crash and what the Clinton administration did to set that up in terms of the policies that were implemented as far as, you know, what he's talking about just proved to me again that 100 years later we still have great inequality, great suffering, budget cuts everywhere, and poor people are poor, and yet CEOs of Enron are running off to the bank.
And you don't think government can do much about it? Joseph Stiglitz?
Well, I have to say I'm much more of an optimist. And I guess if I weren't an optimist, I wouldn't have written the book, because one of the reasons for writing the book is my belief that if people understand what is at issue, I guess I still have a lot of confidence in democracy. I think it would help enormously, as Jack said, if we had campaign finance reform. I think that's an absolutely essential ingredient. But I do think if we can understand what is going on, there will be political pressures to get a fairer system. The problem was that so much of this is done behind the scenes without people being aware of what is going on, not realizing the nature of the corporate welfare, not realizing the nature of the bad accounting problems. You know, as I said, in 93, 94, we were fighting these. The Council of Economic Advisors was fighting to improve the accounting standards, and yet Treasury was opposing it, and it was getting very little public attention. I think if people had understood how serious this issue was, I think there would have been a better chance to have done some of these reforms.
But Jack, coming out of that decade, we have the Bush administration, and to Chris's point, Chris, thanks for your call. They don't seem to be stepping away from the market-driven perspective at all, and certainly not embracing regulation.
No, that's certainly true, that was one of the things that the last election was about, and narrowly because of the electoral system. We chose a new path. I think that it strikes me as a comment on the Clinton Gore years, that even with that economy, even with all those successes, they were not able to use government in the way that Chris says to make this, to help a more level playing field for people. They weren't able to do that enough to get Gore reelected under the most propitious economic circumstances practically you could have.
And that's a fact. We're talking tonight with Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz. He was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Bill Clinton about the U.S. economy, where it's been and where it's headed. You can join us post-Enron, corporate scandal and meltdown. Do you want some regulation back or not? Do we have the right balance between state and market? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the U.S. economy, where it's been and where it's headed, the impact of Clinton policy, Bush policy, and beyond. My guest tonight is Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist and author of the new book, The Roaring 90s, A New History of the World's Most Prosperous Decade. You can join the conversation. What did the economy of the first post-Cold War decade say about the strengths and weaknesses of U.S. economic policy? Was the deregulation dream an expensive mirage? and was what was good for Goldman Sachs, good for the country. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Oh, and I'm told again, our 800 number is on the fritz tonight, but you can try us at 617-353-0645. Nicholas is on the line. Hi, Nicholas. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is the following. I'm wondering what the role of economists is going forward, and I'd like to hear Joseph Stiglitz's opinion on this, particularly when I think of the bust and the predictability of it. I heard Joseph saying that the bust was mainly due to the fact that this exuberance was based on wrong information, and I'm wondering whether that's true. I think most of the information was available, and that people such as Alan Greenspan were able to predict that people were exaggeratedly exuberant. And so my question is, why didn't more economists foresee the bust, try to give the warning signs, and try to prevent it?
Nicholas, we've got it. Joseph Stiglitz, Nicholas is pointing straight at your profession and saying, what about it? What about it? There was enough information. Alan Greenspan was warning of irrational exuberance. What was it? Was there really that big a deficit of information?
Well, I think both played a role. There was undoubtedly some irrational exuberance. But part of the problem was that people really thought that the firms were doing better than they were actually doing. For instance, you didn't take off for when you paid your CEOs with stock options. It didn't come out of wasn't shown as if it were paying a wage. It was like money coming out of the air. Nobody was paying for this. Of course they were, but most shareholders did not understand what was going on, that their share values were being diluted and significantly diluted by what was going on, and therefore the prices that were in the market were excessively high. So there was almost a deliberate intent to give misleading information. The same thing was true about the analysts who were providing information to shareholders at the same time saying the stock is great. At the same time, they were sending emails back to their colleagues saying this is a dog.
So it's Nicholas's question then. Where were the economists who might have been shouting from the rooftops? Is that the job of the economist?
I think, well, the answer is that there was even a recognition by the Fed, as you said, that there was a bubble in play, and yet they did not take the action. The reason, I think, was a little bit ideology. They had some instruments at their disposal. They could have done it without taking down the economy. They could have, for instance, increased margin requirement. We have a record now of minutes of a Fed meeting where this issue was raised early on in the bubble. And yet, and there was actually a statement that this would work. And yet, there was a decision not to do it. I think too many people were enjoying themselves at the party, and so the people enjoying themselves at the party, the government officials, the Fed, did not want to be responsible for bringing down the party. But of course, that meant that when the party came to an end, the burst was all the greater.
Nobody wanted to close the bar. I don't know. That may still leave Nicholas wondering on his question about economists. But everybody was at the party, I guess. Craig's on the line. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I got two questions or comments. Why is it that I hear so many people who are in the upper class, you talk about 2% real wealthy, making over $400,000 a year, why should they dollar-wise pay more taxes and to preserve the economy and so on and so forth? You talked about Clinton raising taxes.
Okay. And your second point, Craig? Got it?
My second point was I think it was Jack Beatty made a comment about deficit reduction lowered interest rates. However, we're going to be facing possibly a $500 billion deficit, and the interest rates are supposedly, I guess, at an all-time low for 40 years.
Joe Stiglitz, you want to pick those two up? Our time's growing short.
Sure. I think the issue of the who should bear the cost of running the government is fundamentally a value issue. And the question is, should those who benefited the most from our society pay a larger contribution? And I think the answer, at least from my point of view, is yes. Remember, during the 70s and 80s and the 90s, it was this upper 2%, the very well-off, who benefited disproportionately. During those decades, during the 70s and 80s particularly, the people at the bottom were actually getting worse off. And so it's just a matter of what I would call just plain fairness. On the issue of the deficits, I think that we are the increase in the deficit that we went, remember, from running about a 2% of GDP surplus at the final years of the Clinton administration to a position now where we're looking at a 5% of GDP deficit. That will inevitably, in the longer run, lead to higher interest rates. The economy is very weak right now, and the Fed has deliberately taken a position of trying to get the interest rates as low as possible to stimulate the economy. It's not working very well, and the deficit have not done very well because they're not very well-designed deficits, because the deficits are all going – the tax cuts went disproportionately to upper-income individuals who don't spend the money as would poor individuals.
And you say in the book, Joseph Stiglitz, that will ultimately come out of everyone's income, rich and poor. Gosh, we're out of time. We need to have you back. There's a lot more to be said, but thanks
Thank
so much
you.
For joining us tonight.
It's great to be here.
Joseph Stiglitz, author of the new book, The Roaring 90s, A New History of the World's Most Prosperous Decade. Listeners, you can continue this full conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org. In a moment, a conversation with the U.S. Ambassador to NATO. Jack Beatty, please stay with us. This is On Point. U.S. and European allies met last week in Madrid and found some common ground in plans for post-war Iraq, but there's still tension over the decision to go to war in the first place. And in Europe, there's talk of creating a European military force independent of NATO. Nicholas Burns is U.S. ambassador to NATO. I asked him today if Europeans now see the world differently from Americans.
Well, obviously, there are many, many differences in both strategic view and other ways between Europe and the United States. But I actually think, as a diplomat who's worked there now for the last 6 years, there's a lot more that unites us with Europe. Certainly, as we look at these very important strategic issues, such as the war on terrorism and the threat that we've got to face, which is the juxtaposition of terrorism with weapons of mass destruction, I think we're very much united with Germany, with France, with the other major states of Europe, in looking at that question now and moving forward to confront it.
It certainly hasn't looked so united in recent months. France opposing the war in Iraq, so did Germany, and all this debate more recently over whether the EU should be able to act independently of NATO with its armed forces. You said recently that the idea which has come up of a European defense project outside the alliance was the most significant threat to NATO's future. Is NATO in trouble? Is the alliance in jeopardy?
I don't think so. I think, in fact, NATO has been rebuilt over the last 2 years by Europeans and by Americans. Obviously, we had a very, very difficult transatlantic relationship over the last year concerning Iraq and significant difference of opinion among Germany, France, and the United States. But the great majority of the European governments actually sided with the United States on the issue of going to war in Iraq. 16 of the 19 NATO allies supported the war. 18 of the allies now have troops on the ground in Iraq. So I think while we did have a significant difference, it is being put behind us. And NATO certainly has been revived over the last 2 years. It was an organization, as you know, that was principally for 5 decades a Cold War institution, but it now has changed into an institution that is going to be, I think, the institution that unites Europe and North America in places like Afghanistan, peacekeeping and nation building in Iraq, where we've got to meet this new threat of global terrorism. So I'm actually more optimistic.
Just last week, you called this a significant threat to NATO's future. Is there a significant threat here or not?
The threat is this. There are 25 countries now in the European Union. 21 of them want to have a cooperative relationship with NATO where the European Union will develop its capacity to act, but it won't try to duplicate what NATO has already built. So NATO will continue to act. NATO will continue to be the preeminent security institution. And it's only when NATO is not involved in a conflict that the European Union would go in with a security force. A small group of countries, France and Germany, Belgium and Luxembourg.
Just happening to include some of the biggest countries in NATO.
They are two of the biggest, yes. They have an alternative view on some of these issues. And we think over time, if their view succeeds, that would be a significant threat to the future of the alliance. I think that the majority of Europeans will decide not to go the way that France and Germany want to go on this particular issue, and I do think we'll be able to hold NATO and the European Union together in a cooperative relationship as we look ahead.
And that issue being whether they would actually set up separate headquarters for a pan-European force that would operate independently of NATO.
That's exactly right, and I think that, as I said before, the great majority of European countries have stood up to say, we can't afford to construct separate headquarters from NATO, and we don't want to do that because we do want to work in a cooperative way with the United States and Canada.
Also, lots of talk around about NATO forces being used as peacekeeping troops in venues from Israel, potentially, to Iraq, to Afghanistan. How widely do you think NATO's forces should be deployed, and for what purpose?
NATO's mission has to be in the greater Middle East, in the Middle East itself, in Central and South Asia, because that's where the great threat is to Europe and the United States. And that's a significant shift in NATO's mission, say, from the Cold War era. NATO now has taken over the peacekeeping operations in Afghanistan. The United Nations asked it to do so, and we did so in August, and I think we'll be there for a significant number of years. 18 of the NATO countries, as I said before, are also in Iraq. And so NATO has made this transition from an institution that was active only in Europe in the past to an institution that is now going to be much more active in places where we need it to be active, we the member states, where we have to either keep the peace, which is certainly the goal in Afghanistan, or in the case of Iraq, to underwrite the period of stabilization there that has to precede the construction of an Iraqi government.
And what about these notions of a further expansion of NATO? Of course, it's expanded into Eastern Europe to 26 countries, a big number now.
Right.
Tom Friedman at the New York Times is saying, hey, why not go further? If the threat is in the south, let's move south. Have Iraq join NATO, Egypt join NATO, Israel join NATO. What do you think of the idea?
I think those are very creative and provocative ideas, but probably not very realistic for the short term. I have great admiration for Tom Friedman, but I think that in the short term, over the next several years, you're going to see NATO grow to 26 countries by 2004. You'll see NATO develop its partnership relationships with Russia, with Ukraine, and with the countries of North Africa, and certainly Israel, Egypt, and Jordan in the Middle East. And that stands to reason, because we need those countries to be supportive of what NATO needs to do in confronting the terrorism and weapons of mass destruction threat. But I don't think the idea of bringing Israel or Egypt in as members anytime soon will work, and those countries have not asked for that kind of membership relationship.
And fundamentally, do you see the interest of the United States and Europe staying on the same page in the years ahead? It's been the rockiest road in the memory of almost all Americans in the last year and a half.
I think we have to remember, going back to Suez in the 50s and Vietnam and the Pershing missile debates of the 80s, we've had a significant number of disagreements, major disagreements, with Europe in the past decades. I do think if you look towards the future, what are the great threats that confront the United States? Global climate change, international crime, international narcotics, the war on terrorism. We can't hope to fight any of those successfully without Europe, and they can't without us. And I think that self-interest, as ever, will keep us together. And I do think that both NATO will remain strong and the transatlantic relationship will remain strong because we face these common threats and we know we need each other to be successful in coping with them. So I do think Iraq was a significant disagreement with some of the major states of Europe, France and Germany most notably, but I don't think that means that somehow we're headed for a separation or a divorce. Quite the contrary. I think we're already seeing the reestablishment of good relations, and I think that will be the focus of our efforts in the future.
Ambassador Burns, thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Nicholas Burns is U.S. Ambassador to NATO. He spoke with me earlier today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jack, Nick Burns is much more diplomatic than Donald Rumsfeld, but I hear that old new Europe theme running right through there. A majority of this expanded NATO of 25, 26 nations will be with the U.S., but that doesn't necessarily include the biggest countries in NATO, among them France and Germany.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, as he was talking about the future of NATO, I think that the U.S. taxpayer has to say, why? What? Something like I'm on record as calling NATO an exorbitant anachronism. Exorbitant because something like $100 billion of ours every year goes to maintain our military footprint there to defend against what? What threat? It is a fossil. And with our new demands in the war on terrorism, I think we're going to see a substantial drawdown of that military commitment, which doesn't weaken our ties of values and interests with Europe.
I wonder, Jack, you may end up on the same page as George W. Bush there. We'll wait and see. Well, Jack, thanks for being with us.
I gulped at that, but thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.